it's an exciting time to rediscover these people who were really, a lot of them, very well known and renowned in their own time. I also want this to be a broader topic on that we discover the treasures in ourselves, and this treasure is creativity, and that these women artists all possess that gift of creativity, a gift that John Brantner quotes, says, creativity is universal and is a distributed human quality. And I'll probably repeat this again, a quote from Madeleine L'Engle, we are constantly being called to be more than we are. She also thinks unless we are creators, we're not fully alive. So I'd like to say that these women's lives are really a tribute to that statement and are an example to us, because many of them lived in times when it was even far more difficult than today to be the artists that they were, and to continue in times when role-playing was even more extreme. Role-playing that we are breaking out of today, that we realized has forced people into areas that neglected these gifts, God-given gifts that were given by a generous creator to express and glorify the creation. In forming this talk, I had first given it to Women in Religion seminar at the seminary, so I had started to research on it. And we actually approached it from the point of view of, is there a women's heritage in the liturgical arts? And I felt that we pretty well established women's work, as long as it stayed into the category of sewing and stitching and embroidery. And we know that some wonderful, beautiful things were done through the years. And we know that the nuns taught this to the aristocratic women that came to the convents to get educated, the wealthier women who were lucky enough to be able to be given an education. And we now honor a tradition in quilts, in the folk arts, and we have lifted many of them up to the era of fine arts and realized that there was a lot of creativeness, a lot of ingenuity and originality in them. So, and I feel we see some of this now in church banners, and we have honored this type of work. But we haven't really looked back into other types of liturgical. As I said, many were educated in the early convents. And we can go back to the nuns in these early years and find some of our first women artists, and who were actually working with the monks in doing the manuscripts. You always heard it was the monks that were sitting up in the monasteries copying the manuscripts, and now we have proof of nuns, and we are getting the names, and some of them we can track down actually identities. So much early work, the artwork was not signed, and artwork was pretty anonymous, and that was part of sort of a cultural heritage too, that you gave to the community and you didn't put your name on it. But it was about the time of the Renaissance that a lot of individualism came forth. But it's interesting, with this individualism came a rise of the more of the role play, and became harder and harder for women to get into the guilds. The guilds were open only to the men, and to be voted into some of these areas where they had been very active. They lost control of guilds that were, even the guilds that were in the weaving and the embroidery. So, and when we got into the industrial area, factories, why many things that were in the home that were considered natural for women was put into factories and became, you know how this role changed. But I want to focus more then on the fine arts. And I'd like to start with the slides and run through the slides and tell you the story of a few people that we've been able to document and track down that are very exciting. As I said, when I was looking for more liturgical art, I found that many of these early women artists were commissioned to do altar pieces and were commissioned to do pieces in the for the nobility, and did do portraits, and were very active, and are in some major churches. Many of these slides, when I document them, are from the Metropolitan Museum. The painting is in the Prado, which shows that they were recognized in their time, and some of them were recognized enough to be in these major museums and purchased, but still did not show up in our history books. I had given another recent talk on combining music and art, and in doing this, I had gone to the library and found a timeline of artists. You know, one of these where they trace all through history, what era. And it was interesting, on this timeline of artists, I found one woman artist represented, which was Mary Cassatt, and only Mary Cassatt even today. Well, then knowing that I was giving this talk at a YWCA women's retreat this summer, and I would repeat it here, just coincidentally, my daughter came home with an art education book that was all on women artists. And why they didn't, you know, why it is their work was not accepted by galleries. They didn't feel women's work would sell as well as men. A lot of put down by men. John Ruskin said no woman could paint because she wasn't creative, and he ate those words in seeing the painting, which I'll show you later. But this timeline appeared in this magazine of Art Education Today, and this is a timeline of women artists. And one of the early ones is Tintoretto's daughter. And the reason her name pops up now is in the cleaning and restoring of artworks. When they were cleaning the signature, they found the signature that she puts on her paintings. And they knew that his daughter painted. And one of the most brilliant pieces he'd done, they began to realize wasn't his, and it was the daughter. Well, then it seems several things happened. The art historians, being a little ruffled and embarrassed, dropped this painting out of his collection rather than saying, oh, we have another collection to pursue, let's follow hers. Later on, I'll mention a woman artist too, who one of the most brilliant pictures by David in my era of taking art history was credited to David. Same thing happened. In restoring the painting, this other signature showed up of one of his most brilliant women students. And now it's accredited to her. It's the fact that she painted so much like the master in a day and age when we revere originality more than we revere a very qualified painting, it didn't pick up as much credibility. But we know, and I've come freshly from Minneapolis, where we have this wonderful women's show that comes from the National Women's Museum, and it has women's art from 1850 to 1950. And the main thing they're saying is there were qualified women painters who were painting very qualified in their day. I have extra copies of this timeline, and this is today in a whole mass of names that joined Mary Cassatt. And this starts way back in 1400s. That's what amazes me. Women in the 1400s who some had families, some decided to that the painting became their whole career. There's another study of women artists, and it finds most of them were daughters of men who painted, because it was very hard for them to get access to the background and the education, just as it was music and a lot of other fields. They were often the daughters, and then and they also had fathers or some person that they knew who was supportive of them. In many cases, the parent was very supportive of this child or this person that showed promise, which gives us another clue of being supportive people when we see some ability like this come forth.
Why do you think Mary Cassatt was accepted? I mean, I knew about her from childhood. Why was she accepted and other people were not?
Well, I think the later women painters became more and more a part of the avant-garde. The earlier women painters were more a part of the established group. And so this came out in the show at the Minneapolis Institute, that they were surprised how conservative this show was. And they said, well, it was daring enough for women to be painting. It was daring enough to be very qualified, but many of them were not allowed, were not able to be with the men in a lot of the avant-garde circles and taught. But Mary Cassatt did move to Paris, was a good friend of Degas, and very much a part of that world. And then she comes into the 20th century, where we are breaking through in the acceptance of her artwork. They do say in her obituary, when she died, she was listed as the daughter of a Philadelphia banker, though. That this prominence has really come a little later.
Was it that she painted mothers and children?
I did pick a mother and child theme one today, and I've only picked one each, but she did paint many other paintings. And I think because she did pick paint a lot of mother child themes, she wasn't considered as avant-garde. But you find many women, the subject matter is children, is people, is often things that were not generally being done. Well, while this was going to come out on the slide, but I'll mention it now. Many women were elected to the academies, but they were very careful, and I have a quote in this book that says, a ruling, though, to be sure that they didn't elect too many. You know, it was very few that were ever elected to the academies. And then they weren't full members, because full members were allowed the privileges of their classes and their life classes, which would be nude drawing. And up to only about 1870 were women allowed nude drawing classes. Even women models, they weren't allowed in the class. And so in the 1800s, many of the paintings were big documentaries with lots of figures. And of course, if you hadn't had a lot of figure drawing background, your ability as a figure drawer would be a little limited, that many of them were limited that way. So there were a lot of, and then galleries that wouldn't show their work and so on. Back in the early ones, it's very interesting, the people who commissioned paintings, though, were the nobility, were the aristocrats, and were the church. And many of them commissioned women artists. And so it depended on who was doing the commissioning. The minute the system changed to galleries, then they weren't so sure of women artists. And it's interesting, this notion that they would paint delicate, you know, the same verbiage. When you paint strong, heavy brush strokes, then you paint like a man. And if you paint lightened ones, then you paint like a woman. And we still say that. I had one interesting class where the only one that painted these beautiful, soft colors was this one man in the class. And it was wonderful. It just was great to point this out, that these are not characteristics that we read into it. Well, let's get started way back and run through the slides first, because there's many things that read into it, and this will come up. And I'd like to start with backtrack one. This is Gouda, a nun that lived in the 12th century. Now, figure back how far that is. And ahead of her was Enda, and I don't have an illustration. And she did manuscripts and what they called scriptoriums. I just love that name. Here was a whole nunnery that was a scriptorium, and they did all the embellishments and some of the manuscripts. But Gouda put her name down. There she is on the left, and she did a little portrait. That was a little daring in a time when they did all this embellishment and everything was very anonymous. So now we have some record of Gouda. In fact, I could have had several slides where she does one then of Mary that looks quite like she does, of course. It's very stylized, and it's amazing how we can track this down. But Gouda down in the 12th century was part of a lot of women in the nunneries that were doing things. We have 12th century Diniad of West Bruin in Bavaria, where the nuns were the scribes, and there were 45 books attributed to this one convent. There were all these scriptoriums that were from 800 AD up through the 12th and 13th century. One had 9 women scribes. Hildegard of Bingen, maybe she was German. Maybe many of you have read some of her her writings. And she wrote mystical treatises. She had visions. She wrote songs, poetry, established a moral order where the order is in yourself and then the world. And she talked about the integrity of the cosmos, body and soul, and illustrated all her books. There was Sabina, the daughter of the sculptor of Strasbourg Cathedral, who finished the sculptures after her father died and carried it on a bit further. Now this is, we're jumping now a couple of centuries up into 1548, and this is Van Hesseman, a Dutch woman, and they believe that this is her sister playing the virginals. And this was an era great in portraiture, so many of these are portraits. She was married, and they figure she did this portrait when she was 20 years old. This is the other element that's so amazing, is many of these women were so young when they were so accomplished and accepted. She married a musician, and both her husband and she were invited to the court of Mary of Bavaria, Mary of Hungary. And when she abdicated her Netherlands throne and moved to Spain, she invited both she and her husband to the court in Spain. And after she had retired, or she gave them a lifelong annuity, I guess we call it today, or lifelong pension to live on. And they were very well recognized and treated. Look at the hands. The artistic comment was many of these portraitures never did learn how to paint the hands very well, these wonderful curvy little fluctuating fingers. Now she, this particular painting was done in 1548. Her father, now again, her father had been a painter. She was the daughter of a painter who nourished this painting ability. Now we move up to, this is an Italian, Lavina Fontana. And she lived, this particular painting was done in 1570. She lived in 1552 to 1614. They have now traced down 135 works attributed to her, many altarpieces. She did many portraits of many cardinals, popes, which means she was commissioned and by the church, which means she was very well recognized. She did an altarpiece in St. Paul's outside the walls in Rome, which would be a very prestigious one and well known. In some of her writings of her life, she tells about a group of 23 women in Bologna that were painters and accomplished painters. She was married, and we have a record that she had 11 pregnancies, which will tell you there was a double role, that these were also women who were part of this, their own culture. She lived to be 64. I've also done a study of older painters. So in some of these, I have their dates, and I'm really amazed, even at these years where the life expectancy was so low, the age that some lived. In the talk I've given on older artists, you know, Michelangelo was 89, Titian was 99, and these men did some of their best work. Over one of Titian's best paintings he did after he was 80. So there's another whole talk that's really fascinating. A lot of paintings that were altarpieces. And this particular one, because this is the slide I could get a hold of, though, is a court scene. This is Clara Peters. We're back into the Dutch realm. It's interesting how many Dutch painters seem to be represented in this era. The Dutch that you think of as being so strict and Calvinistic kind of an... living a life that was a little more confirmed than the conformity than the Italians, but it seemed with all the individuality in the Renaissance, they got back to a little more of the role playing and the exclusion of women. This one was done in 1635, and they've traced back dates, and she did this when she was 17 years old. They have not been able to document her as being a student of any particular artist. There's no record, you know, of a father or anyone. They feel she was self-taught. The way they get records or get background and document some of this is records of art schools or other artists' comments, and thank goodness people kept diaries and journals, or we wouldn't know a lot of this. And then also the dates on the paintings and different record, but there's no record of training. She lived in 1594 to 1657, and she really pushed this type of a still life into a new genre. It is, they used to call this kind of, like this would be a breakfast or dinner still life, because it contained food and the nuts. Now, I was hoping this would show up in the blow up, but on that right-hand pewter container, or coffee pot, whatever it is, there's a little highlight. Her portrait is in that highlight in the original painting. And this was typical of what they had. See that little highlight on the edge of that picture on the right? You can't, you'll just have to imagine it's there. But her portrait is there. I was hoping when I read that I'd be able to blow this up enough to see.
It's on this piece?
Yeah, right there in the middle, right there. This was typical of them to put a reflection. And it's quite popular today to do paintings with reflections in windows. And you think that they did this back then and showed a little scenery. But she showed herself painting the painting, which also documents it pretty well. Her technique in doing the flowers and doing is very rich, and with these dark backgrounds, and very different than they were done before. They're sort of decorative, but beautiful in its detail and beautiful in the dark backgrounds.
Where is that painting though?
Pardon me?
Is that painting in?
I didn't write this down, but I've got a book where we could document it. A few of them I do have where they are.
What's on the lower left? It almost looks like Rosemont.
Yeah.
It's
a big
red peony.
It's like a peony, yeah. Oh. And then a little rose, yeah, from the distance.
It's a little white thing that touches
it. I think that's a rose bud laying down.
Yeah, or a bud of them.
And I'm not sure what that blue thing is. I think that's also a flower that's fallen.
And sort of, and what that little thing is next to the chalice, I'm not quite sure. It looks like an onion ring or something. See, they're eating kind of these pretzel type things. Well, look at it. It's sort of like pretzels, aren't they? And cookies, and then nuts.
It's breadsticks.
And there's the wine.
It's a pretzel.
Well, these wonderful still lifes and the imaginativeness that's in it, and the depth they get in them. But the Dutch ones are always dark, though. There's always these very dark backgrounds. And even I could have pointed out, art-wise, if we wanted to critique these paintings, the early one of the girl playing the virginal, there's very little depth behind her. There's a chair behind her, but you don't go into the room. You don't go back into distance much. Now, this is Judith Leister. And she, this was done in 1611, when they feel too, she was quite young. Forgotten now. She was born 1609 to 1660. Now she was from a very well-off family. She was elected to the Guild of St. Luke, which would be a very high honor for a woman and distinguished. She was married. She retained her maiden name, and this comes up time and again, so I thought there's nothing new. Very interesting. Here's this very Hausfrau-looking Dutch woman. This is a portrait that she's done for herself, which I picked out several times, which I think is kind of fun to see what they look like. I can't imagine she sat around painting with that white ruff on, and maybe she did. Maybe she snuck in after she did something else. But there are these very normal people, part of their time.
Somebody plays to her?
That's her painting.
She did, what's interesting is she did a lot of portraits of the Calvinist dignitaries. And you think of Calvinist doctrines and how the graven images and being very stern and no embellishments in the church, but they like to have their portraits painted. And they had them in these severe costumes. The ruff was really about the most decorative thing that was there. Now, she was Franz Hals' pupil, and not this particular painting, but she's the one that one of her other paintings was attributed to Franz Hals for years and years. In fact, it's only up within the last, I'd say, 25 years that these discoveries have been made, where we've been conscious of the fact of the question, why were there no women artists? And they began to realize, well, there were. And some of these that were purchased, I remember seeing some of these paintings, but it just never occurred to me when I looked at the name that the first name was a woman. I think we're a little more conscious of that, too. What I think is fun about this study is so many of them were active, recognized, living very full artistic lives. They weren't painting in the closet, so to speak, if that's what we want. Now, this is Artemisia Gentileschi. We're back to Italy. This is an Italian painter. And she lived 1593 to 1657. It has been proven that she earned her living through her paintings. Her father was a painter, so she's someone that learned, did have good art training through the support in the family. She's represented in many museums. She's done pictures or paintings of St. John the Baptist, a lot of Old Testament women. She lived in Rome, Florence, Naples, and London. And this always surprises me how these people travel around the day and age. We think we're the travelers. That they moved around from court to court and fit right into the scene. Many of these women were married, the families went with. Now her paintings are owned by the Detroit Museum and the Metropolitan Museum. So I would call her recognized, and yet she wasn't on this art list that I was operating with this other talk. Now her name comes up, even though she has been purchased by major museums. So that is Artemisia Gentileschi. Now this is Rachel Reisch, 1664. You can guess, she's back to the Netherlands in their tradition. She's Dutch, she had 10 children. Lived a pretty full life. She lived to be 86 years old. So didn't wear her down. In that day and age, that was really, even today, that's a ripe old age. She was from an educated family. She had been elected to the guild, so these are the really outstanding ones. She was married to another artist. So this often happens to women who are trained in art or whose father's been artist, they marry another artist so that the support and the keeping active is there. She was a member of the guild, did I mention that? And she also retained her maiden name. Now I think you have seen her work. These dark background, these beautiful flowers, and this rich tradition of floral still lifes. But I think I've seen her name too and just never really read the Rachel part of it. Now this is one that's fun to tell you more about. Whoops, I'm sorry. Well, come on back. Yeah. This is Elizabeth Vigée Lebrun, and she was the portress for Marie Antoinette. And I picked her portrait of Marie Antoinette because you maybe never thought of Marie Antoinette this way, the family woman, with her children and an empty cradle with a black drape designating the child who had died as a baby, put into the portrait that way. She didn't put any political meanings in her paintings, but she did put, see the column behind her head, she did use a lot of neoclassic things and a little hint of things to come. She, now she too was very well recognized. She was married, had two children. She was elected to the Royal Academy in Paris and in Rome. And I believe she was 27 years old when she was the court portrait painter. And usually that meant you lived at Versailles or you lived in the court. She was a good personal friend of Marie Antoinette. And one good painting she did when they complained of how much it cost to buy that, Marie Antoinette took it and put it in a closet and it was saved somehow. Somehow she was lucky enough to get out of Paris before the revolution and was in Italy when she heard the news that Marie had been beheaded and felt quite sad about it. But it's interesting that she escaped the revolution and went on and joined many other courts as their painter. She originally, and I believe when she was 17, she did portraits and helped support her family. Then later on, the story is that she had the two children, that her husband was a gambler. And that he was an art dealer. And much of the money that she made supported the family because of this. But they moved around and she joined other courts and lived a life, a very fruitful life, a very full life as an artist and gaining her. Now this is just a slide I found of an art studio with women that I thought was kind of fun. And their long skirts and
all of
that,
not mixed.
Yeah, that particular one. Well, they wouldn't want to mix them up, my goodness. Yeah. This woman's name is Kaufman. I forgot her first name. Yeah, somehow this does not have a focus mechanism. I don't know if anyone could focus that. This happens to be her portrait, which I picked just because it's kind of fun to see what they look like. Oh, did I say Vinji Labrenia lived to be 87, too, with that life? And think of her being Marie Antoinette's portrait painter. Portraiture was such an important part of painting, and this was the height of it at that time. And many of them did altar pieces also and religious paintings. But the portraiture kind of comes forward. Maybe it was easier for women to be commissioned for this. I don't know. Kaufman now here lived about at the same time of Vigée Le Brun. She lived 1741 to 1827, because she lived to be 66. She was very successful in her time, very famous, was admired, and even made the remark she got so many commissions that she wondered if there just weren't any other artists that were being asked to paint. It was just amazing to read about her. Very popular, gave studio parties, and mixed with many of the cultural people in that era. When she died, she was buried in Rome at the Pantheon next to Raphael. She was considered that important. She had a husband that devoted his life to just seeing that she could paint and serving her. Sounds much like some of the creative people that age says. Well, it's Kaufman. I don't know why I've looked this up. I have her name. I'm sorry, I've skipped her first name somehow right here. Her work was quite neoclassical, which is rather unpopular now. So her work is considered rather sentimental. And she painted quite a bit like Reynolds and quite a bit like David. So I think that's why we haven't heard about her. She's sort of gone down in taste. And some of these people now will reappear again when we are not quite as critical and not as avant-garde minded. And often they will take their place again. Now this is Constance Marie Charpentier, who's French. And this is the painting she did in 1800. And she lived to be 74 years old. She was a pupil of David, who was a very famous neoclassicist. And when I went to art school, this was David. And this is the painting they found and was considered one of his best. This is of a countess. They have now found out it was her painting. They credit it to her. And
is it a drawing or a painting?
No, this is a painting.
In black and white?
No, this slide is poor. It's been taken out of a book. I'm sorry. Yeah.
There is some color, though?
Yeah, this one is in color, and I'm sorry this slide is in color. It's beautifully painted in beautiful soft shades with that deep background. I think she's in rose shades with light hair, and it's really very beautifully done in this neoclassic style. Now this is Rosa Bonheur. Yeah, now here's a woman painter.
Oh, look at those bright colors. She's in trouble.
Hey, listen here. I think this is, I'm sorry, this is Lady Peters, I'm sorry. This is an English woman who was very wealthy, married to a title, otherwise her name was Marie Thompson, but her name is Lady Peters, and all her paintings are these big military paintings or horse paintings, and she is the one that John Ruskin made the remark that no women could be painters because they were not creative, and it said he ate his words. And he also said that any painting that was so admired by the public could not be that good. And then he comes back and sees it and says the horse, particularly on the right, he thought was so beautiful, and the painting and the figures in it. Another art critic I was reading though said, well, she was like Cecil B. DeMille. Many, many figures and all this sort of glorification and all this groupings of horses and people.
Do you know anything about her? I mean, where did she get the material for this?
Well, now she's a little bit later in that she's 1881, and so she was even though women had not been allowed to do much figure drawing, she was allowed in studios in England. Things were starting to change, and she did a lot of background painting.
She did some photographs?
There weren't the photographs. Observation, studying horses, having people come pose in military uniforms. John Ruskin has said he was the only painter she'd seen since Turner that put such a beautiful got this illusion in the background of the smoke and the gunpowder and the fog. I can look her up later when we get through the slides if you wish. Now I'm sorry, this is Rosa Bonheur. No, I'm sorry. Now this woman was very well recognized, Rosa Bonheur. She was born 1822, 1899, right through the Victorian era. She didn't marry. She lived to be 78. She dedicated her whole life to art. She really pioneered the idea of doing animals. She did lions and tigers and sheep and these are huge paintings. When someone thinks painters today do big paintings, why do they do them so big we could never get them in our houses? These are these huge things that are a whole wall. Her father was a painter, and he was quite a believer in the equality of women, and it was amazing to read that he belonged to some group or believed, after it was called St. Simonson, I believe, who also believed in a woman messiah. And I think back in the Victorian age, to think there was some group that had these beliefs. So he did believe in the equality of women and saw that his daughters were given educations and were supported in the background they wanted to go into, and art was the field here. And she surpassed her brothers and sisters and became famous. She, to get the background on how she knew how to paint the horses, she used to go down to the butchering shops, the livery stables, the butchering shops, and go down and even dissect the animals to learn about muscles. And to be accepted down there, she would wear men's clothes. It said she had to register with the police to wear men's clothes so that she had the okay. And found it was easier to get access to places like this to study up for painting. At the age of 17, she was accepted she had a show in the Paris Salon. She was very popular with people, and I think she did over 300 different prints. She did do an etching of this, which I think every grade school had for many years, not knowing it was Rosa Bonheur. This is really quite an advance to the type of painting the Victorians or the age neoclassic did. They would have had horses rather stiff and standing in a row and very romanticized, but hers are full of life, full of action, full of vitality, almost Wagnerian, right? Of course, in each age, there was always many different focuses going on, and those who were sentimental and reach back to the past, those were very avant-garde, because at the same time some very exciting modern painting was starting. And I think that's why you don't hear her name so much anymore. Now that we've gone on to more avant-garde, Rosa Bonheur is considered a little more too romantic, too Wagnerian, and so on.
She was French, wasn't she?
She was French, yeah. Rosa Bonheur. And that's her in her studio. Oh. Isn't that kind of fun? With the men's pants on, she had skins of animals, and she's sitting there with a framed painting, which seems funny.
She framed it before she finished.
Yeah, and she's doing a very famous one of lions that I think once you'd seen it, you'd probably realize you might have been familiar with it. Now we come to Mary Cassatt, who was the only one who was brought up in a very prim, proper, aristocratic as far as American background. Her father was a Philadelphia banker. She was sent to art school, but often the art schools that women were sent to were a little more conservative and not always the more radical or avant-garde. She did, though, pursue her art far enough to know that she wanted to go to Paris and did really study in Paris. And I think that at one period, when we're looking for American painters, people who studied in Paris were not were considered European trained and European style. So that's what kind of happened to Mary Cassatt too. And then I think we realized her credibility. She did not marry, never had any children. These are her sister's children, friends' children. And she was very influenced by Japanese prints. Her family used to come to Paris and stay with her a long time though, and seemed to keep up their ties there. And she was a very good friend of Degas and really was more a part of the painting and community than many other artists. Another slide I should have brought, I just brought one each, and I thought the mother and child ones were so nice, is she has one of the boating party, quite like Monet's, two people out in a boat, and it's like you're sitting in the front part of the boat. She has some landscapes, and she was a very prolific painter. She did live to be 86 years old, but something I didn't realize, she was blind the last 6 years of her life. John Brantner had told me this, a psychologist. And because she was a painter, she became very depressed because she couldn't paint. But instead of using her creativeness and using it in a way with her own life, if she'd realized she could have done maybe sculpture or something she'd done with her hands, she perhaps could have kept this spirit up. Okay, this is a fun one. This is Marie Hauge, who is, if you look up a study of Norwegian painters, you will find her name listed. And maybe the Marie will kind of skip it. And this is a photograph I got from the woman whose father owned this farm. And this is called the Tennant Farm Family. And is in a museum in Lillehammer. And we went to see this painting, and it happened, it wasn't being hung, it was in their permanent collection. And then they gave me this photograph that they had on their family farm. So this is how she came and painted. Sat up her easel, wore her flowered skirt, put her hat on, and went to work. It's a beautiful painting, and in the galleries in Norway and Oslo, you can get large reproductions of this painting. Also, and the original hangs there. It's a beautiful painting. So she's one of a group there. This is Kathy Kollwitz, who is German. This painting was done in 1921. And she died in 1945, so we're kind of catching up. She stayed in the graphics or print medium. I believe this might be a lithograph, and this is her portrait. She lived through both World War I and II as a German, lived in Germany, and she's a real example to me of the other side of the German people. You keep wondering, you know, who were they all when the Nazis were there and so on? Very sensitive, all her drawings are about working people, about oppressed people, are about tragedy, dying, or just mother and child sympathies. She was encouraged by her father as an artist. Her husband, and then when she married, her father was afraid she'd give up her art, but it continued on. Her husband was a doctor in a very oppressed, poor area of Berlin, and she would draw the people. And she kept doing the graphics because she, in the drawings, she thought then they could afford to buy the drawings, and she didn't want to get into paintings where it would become rather an elitist thing to buy. Her own son was killed in World War I. Her grandson was killed in World War II. During the Nazi regime, she did paint in her studio, but was not allowed to ever exhibit. She has paintings that she calls, now that's called, it's about getting the news of wartime killing. And she very much was against war, and many of her drawings are protesting war and showing what the ravages of the war are, what the outcomes on the families are, what the tragedy is. And I think she has a real voice, and you're seeing more and more of her paintings come to light now. Very sensitive. Kathy Kollwitz, German. And this is, now I'm Susan Baladon. I'm getting into more contemporary era, not going to tell you quite as much about them because I think some of these women are a little more recognized and are getting more into the avant-garde. This is Isabel Bishop, and she was very popular in the 30s. She's in her 80s now, and an example of artists that keep going and never stop, and is very active, has her studio in New York City. This print was in a show of women printmakers of the 30s that was in Minneapolis. That was Marie Lorenzen before. This is Susan Baladon. She was married to an artist. This is Marisol, who were from Venezuela, and she works in more pop art and works in sculpture. It's sculpture and pop art. This is Alice Neal, who just died last year at 84. She had her first major painting show in 1974 in her 70s, but painted all her life and has gone to this whole series of these very strong portraits or figure drawings that really show the psychology of the person, and many of hers are famous because of the people she painted. She's not painting like the popes and the kings and queens, and she is painting the average person, the unusual person, the person of the street, the clowns, and a whole bit of humanity. She's also done many other landscapes and animals and other things too. I have several articles on her that that tell about the rest of her life, if you'd like to come up and see them. And this is Louise Nevelson, and she is the person who really pushed the whole idea of the found object. You know, when you take a piece of driftwood and you put it on your shelf or you put it on your table, make a flower arrangement, why, you know, nobody would be caught dead putting a piece of dead wood on the table many years ago. And she went around and collects pieces of wood and puts them together in these boxes and areas, and these become sculptures. Now, one of these is called Sky Cathedral. And this one's called New Continent. Now, she's 85 years old, lives in New Canaan, Connecticut, is very active in her artwork. She is now beginning to distribute her work to art museums. Her latest commission was the Lutheran Chapel in a New York building. Now, what is the building? I forgot. Pardon me?
City
Court.
St. Peter's.
She is Jewish. She was commissioned by the Lutheran Church and has, I don't have slides of them, I wish I did, of these panels that are in the chapel. Yeah?
Are they the doors?
The whole chapel.
No, I think they're different sides of it. I've seen slides of it, but wasn't able to get a hold of it. And I think they're white. Her things are sometimes black, sometimes all white. But here's an example of picking a woman who has a great sense of the world and of space and relationships, and having the church commission and use her today. This is a picture of her. I met her when she was in Minneapolis at 74. When people, her work is very, of course, in big numbers now, but she said when a doctor approached her that knew her before, wanted to buy her work, she said, I'm not selling it now. I don't need the money now at 86, and I want to be sure my work is in the certain museums where it should be a part of their collection. When I needed that money and didn't have any money, and you didn't buy my work, that's when I needed it. Now I don't need it. So I'm very sorry I missed bringing the slides of Georgia O'Keeffe, one of my favorites, who, you know, died at 99 just a year ago. And work is such, I think you all know her work. I had one of hers, New York City, and one of them Looking Through the Bones in New Mexico, and one of them of her big iris, and she's my favorite. And how those slides got missed, I don't know. But her life too has been such a wonderful example. And now we do know about her, and these are in the era where they accept. This is Judy Chicago, and this is her Emily Dickinson plate. I thought this began fun. That was in her dinner table series. And this is her Susan B. Anthony plate. And I'm not going to go in much further, but she did this whole dinner party series, quite feminist, quite avant-garde. This is Helen Frankenthaler, born 1922, and really quite an example of a woman being recognized and working very, and I wanted to show one that was very abstract and works very free and loose in working. And that's the slide, so I'll have the lights.
Okay.
And I say we got a little time left for discussion. I did bring one book with me, Women Artists, that covers a lot these same artists and things about them. And there is something about Rosa Bonheur or Peters or Mary Cassatt if you want to read a short biography.
Can you find out the
most
big books
to us? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, here's something. Women Artists in the Academies in the 18th Century. This was a statement and debate at the Royal Academy. These admissions of women to the Royal Academy, foreign in some way to its constitution, must not be allowed to become too numerous.
Well, I'm surprised. What are those earlier ones?
Aren't they?
I expected these to be mostly 19th century, you know, to 18th century.
Here's a wonderful picture of Alice Neal, and she finally did herself in the nude when she's about 80, and I think it's in the president's office of Harvard, but she said, "I don't draw beautiful people, I only draw people because of their character." So she said, "I was too beautiful when I was young, so I finally did it when I was older." It was wonderful. And here are many of her pictures. Here's a whole article on Elizabeth McGee LeBrun, and this is her picture. Yep. And if anybody cares to have a copy, I have several copies of that chart. But I think much of this brings out how we put people in role plays, and then the opposite, how people who do have a treasure and recognize it and get support from some people, how they dared in the age they were in. Like, I think this lady Peters, the energy in that military painting was compared to the energy that went into Florence Nightingale and her pursuing her career. The energy it must have taken and the courage. And recognizing that as a human quality, creativity is universal and is in all. Are there any other questions or anything we can discuss now? We've got a couple minutes. Of, yeah.
Would you talk about that gal that did the plates? She's in the Science Center, you know, in the Science Center in the Seattle.
They have Well, she's a very strong feminist, and she's done what she calls the dinner party. And, you know, it was a whole project where she engaged other women to do the ceramics, and each plate represents some well-known woman.
But she didn't do it all herself.
She just did another project now with, I think it was on birth, that was all fiber, and she got women across the country to work on that and then trying to get that exhibited. She's a younger one and very much a part of the feminist movement.
Are many of these earlier paintings, are they in galleries? Have they been in galleries?
Well, see, there's the paradox. Many of them were and were recognized in their time, and then we say, well, what happened to them in art history? And this is what happens to an art history, written by men art historians, or judging history in terms of men's stories and not women's stories, just like the history of America or the pioneer woman and so on. Many of them were popping in their time, and then the taste changed a bit, and we, instead of recognizing.
So they were in the back, who were they in? Basements of galleries, or I mean, what's happened to the actual paintings?
Oh, well, one of them, I said, is in the Detroit Museum. Another one's in the Prado and has been there for a long time. It must have been purchased when she did it, and it is now in the Prado Museum. So why that isn't in an art history book? They are there. That's what I thought was interesting. They are there. They were recognized, and that's kind of exciting. They were recognized.
The horse.
Oh, where did I say it? Can't remember, but I'd say Rosa Bonheur was the most recognized, was like a national hero. She was very well known in that Victorian era, and she was painting the way in an acceptable style. But you have to remember, this is the same time that Cézanne was coming along, and Mary Cassatt was really almost at the same time beginning in very different style, that she fit within that age. And the minute we turned our back on Victorianism, or we began to call that something else, her popularity went down, and then the art books then dropped her off. So we're sort of reclaiming, and this maybe is true of a lot of people in other fields too. Yeah.
In that book, Women Artists, does it tell you where their paintings are?
Yeah, I think it does document them, and I just couldn't go into all those details. Sometimes I put them down here in fine print, but or some of the important ones. Yeah, Jerry.
I've been collecting art based on Luke's Esteemed Prodigal Son story for about 4.5 years and have over 240 examples. One is by a woman.
Yeah.
And that is in the National Gallery of Art, Washington, D.C., by Mary Ann Wilson, W.I.S.O.N.
Oh, yeah, I did.
And it's called The Prodigal Son of Misery. And I have a couple of paragraphs here that are interesting that share a little bit of insight into that particular artist, Mary Ann Wilson, 1800 to 1825. This vigorous, imaginative, ingenious group of drawings is a very free appropriation of designs and motives based on a series of engravings of 1814 by an American engraver in the studio. A glimpse of Mary Ann Wilson's life and viewpoint is found in a notice signed, quote, "an admirer of art," end quote, which gives a contemporary account of Miss Wilson's at work. And this is the account. "The artist Miss Wilson and her friend Miss Bundridge came from one of the eastern states and made their home in the town of Greenville Green County, New York. Bought a few acres and built or found their house made of logs on the land at and where they resided for many years. One was the farmer and cultivated the land by the aid of neighbors occasionally doing some of the plowing for them. This one planted and reaped and gathered in while the other made pictures,"
yeah,
"which she sold to the farmers and others as rare and unique works of art. Their paints or colors were the simplest kinds, berries, bricks, and occasional store paint made up their wants for these elegant designs. Mm-hmm. These two maids left their home in the East with a romantic attachment for each other, and which continued until the death of the farmer maid. The artist was inconsolable, and after a brief time, removed to parts unknown. The writer of this often visited them and takes great pleasure in testifying to their great simplicity and originality of character, their unqualified belief that these pictures," P-I-C-T-E-R-S, "that these pictures were very beautiful and original," they certainly were, "and boasting how greatly they were in demand. Why, they go way to Canada and clear to Mobile." "They had not the slightest idea how ridiculous they were. Their perfect simplicity and honest earnestness made them and their works more interesting. The writer of this little sketch does not mean to compare these mineral and vegetable compounds of fantastic taste with the more artistic work of Cole, Durant, Huntington, and others, but simply as the work of a native artist, uneducated, of course, but a proof of the unnecessary waste of time old masters in Italian travel."
A lot of it's our values. See, we were valuing Europe, and had to come from Europe, or had to be Greek or Western. I think now we're opening up folk art. We're recognizing people who did natural things, and the museums are maybe slow to this. Many major museums did not collect ethnic products and heritage items. That was sort of in the historical society, and they missed some things, and now they're beginning to realize. And I think changing attitudes of what's valuable and what's really art and what's what we want to carry through in our heritage, and let's hope that it's changing values of what we feel are treasures, and treasures that can be something important to us all, treasures within people. There are nations that make treasures out of people. They make them national treasures and people that were their creative people. And that we can make individuals treasures, we can make people national treasures, or we can realize we've got that treasure right within us.